Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, our cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. In this, the first show of our third series, we rip it up and start again with a major exhibition of Eduardo Palazzi's work. We peer into Victorian London and all its mystery with local author William Sutton, and we access all areas at the Guildhall. There's also a quick roundup of local events and a reflection on the passing of two media greats. With me, as ever, is another media great to lead me to the Enchanted Kingdom. It's Dave Allen. Dave, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I hope I can live up to that.
I'm sure you can. Simon, unfortunately, is not well for this recording, but we're soldiering on without him. Now, this is an exhibition that's taking place at the moment at the Pallant House Gallery in Chichester, and this is Eduardo Palazzi.
It is indeed.
I think I got it right that time.
I think you did.
Right. Yeah. So there's a number of things that I'm keen to start with on this one. I read a great quote, which I think is from the man himself. He said that all human experience is one big collage.
Did he indeed?
He did. I think that's a quote from him. Now, that gives a clue as to his sort of style and his format and his approach. But collage, I think when you use that word, people just think of torn bits of paper. And there's some of that, isn't there? But there's a kind of a cross-media approach.
There is a kind of primary school assumption about collage.
There is, really, or
a kind of Christmas card assumption about it. Yeah, but I think actually that there's a bigger claim to be made for collage, a huge claim to be made for collage, which is that it's conceivable, at least in Western culture, the dominant process and practice, the dominant way of making sense of the world that we've inherited from the 20th century. Now, that's a pretty massive claim, but we can throw all sorts of examples at that. Palazzi is a good example of it, but we're talking there about, if you like, the rarefied world of the visual arts. So if we go instead to somewhere like Jamaica in 1970 and think about people like Lee Scratch Perry and the work that those producers did around dub reggae, where they were taking tracks and then sampling bits and pieces and working them in on very primitive equipment. Mm. And then you think the way that people in music have taken that, we're talking about 40 years now of people doing that. And of course, in a sense, that was an inheritance from European avant-garde and American avant-garde, from John Cage and Stockhausen and so on. That's one example of where you see it all the time.
It's kind of infused, isn't it? Kind of over time, it's gradually sort of crept in as a stable influence.
I think it has. I mean, another good example of it would be the plethora of documentary programmes on television, which once upon a time, the tradition of documentary, I mean, if you think about the first great documentary film, 1922, Flaherty's Nanook of the North, and he goes off and lives with the Eskimos, and he constructs a narrative film in which he points a camera at these Eskimos living their lives, and it's brought back to us, and we're encouraged to think of it as a kind of true record, a fly on the wall record. Now, there are all sorts of questions about that, but that's what we're encouraged to see it. So that in a sense the camera is innocent and is recording, and then they just edit it neatly and show it. But if you think about modern documentaries, you know, you think about a documentary about life in London, that would be constantly a collage. I mean, the word we normally use there is montage, but it would, you know, it would have people shopping in Oxford Street, it would have people getting on the tube, it would have people going to work in the city, it would have people selling the big issue or sleeping in doorways. And there would be cuts to images taken from 19th century novels, you know, to compare it, or Hogarth's Gin Lane, and then we cut back to the modern world and so on. So everywhere in our lives, and you walk down the street now, I mean, I've just walked here through Portsmouth Guildhall Square, you know, so I walk up past the Theatre Royal, and there are, anyway, all these pubs and bars and all sorts of other things with neon and images in the window and adverts, and you walk into the Guildhall Square and there's this majestic building, and right in front of you there's South Today being broadcast, and you know, 3 million miles of screen on the far far distance, and all of that, you know, everywhere you go there are bits and pieces of things. And so as I walk through it, as it happened, there was a story from the Lib Dem conference about a Portsmouth councillor, and I didn't hear the story. I know what the story is. I mean, it's a fairly well-known story, but I didn't hear the outcome of it or why they'd introduced it tonight. So you just get a little snatch. And, of course, I think what artists tend to do is to recognise that this is not infuriating. This is actually the modern experience And what they want to do is to make equivalents of it in their work. And I think Paolozzi recognised that earlier than most people.
So this is kind of collage as a, I suppose, a means of expression and, yeah. and a way of, I suppose, in the same way as a diary might, yeah. capturing yeah. and recording yeah. time and progress. You know, rather than just the primary school, right. here's a picture of yeah. an elephant or whatever it is that I've made out of bits of magazine. Yeah. This is much more about those snapshots being collated yeah. together to, I suppose, create a sense of a time and a... And an era, almost, I suppose.
I agree with that, absolutely. And it could be a diary in which you actually paste a bus ticket or you paste, a shopping receipt, you know, and people say, well, that's not a very beautiful object. But then alongside that, you make some drawing and then you say, well, there was a, when I walked through the Guildhall Square, there is a kind of dominant colour, which is a sort of stone grey against glass, you know. And so you might make little drawings of that, which would be sort of monochrome. And there might be all those kinds of things. And there are other aspects to it as well, because what it's about is it's partly about fragments and fragmentation and partly about bringing them all together and blending them and so then you begin to ask questions about psychology and sociology, if you like, you know, and you start to say, do we think we live in a fragmented society, or do we think that what's often called multiculturalism is not fragmented at all, but is actually rich and diverse, but lots and lots of different things? And so I guess there will be, in the work that people make in collage, that there might be different approaches. I mean, the one of the famous examples pre-war in Nazi Germany was a man called John Hartfield, who made very provocative political collages and photo montages, anti-fascist, you know, and he risked, you know, his safety, his personal safety, to make that remarkable work. There's a contemporary man called Peter Kennard who tends to do it still. Paolozzi, I think, was more is more reflecting back the kind of world that we inhabit.
So how important is Paolozzi to British pop art? Or I've heard his work described as radical surrealism.
Yeah.
Now, that could be a whole documentary, I guess,
in
terms of what that is. But how important is he to the kind of the pop art
sure
scene?
Could. Well, I think the first thing to say is that there's a sense in which true surrealism is always radical, actually, politically, socially, in all kinds of ways. And in fact, the word surreal is now an appallingly misused word. You know, it's normally now used by footballers who say, oh, I've just been picked for Wales, it's really surreal. No, it isn't surreal, actually. So that's completely the wrong word, you know, and it makes me furious.
It's almost a bit like the word awesome, isn't it?
Awesome, know? Yeah, and icon is another one. I think people should be shot for using those words if they don't know what they mean, really.
He's always been a balanced liberal, I think.
But I mean, that's the kind of response that a surrealist would make, you see. I think that surrealist thread running through it is a very useful one, and there's no reason why we can't think of some elements of pop art as being like that. The thing about pop art is that, like so many, it's a very accessible art movement, you know, because it's got kind of real images in it. It's easier than pure abstraction. It's certainly easier than cubism, you know. So you can go to it and you can say, well, I don't like those cans of Campbell's soup that Warhol's made, but at least I know what they are, you know. I don't like that picture of a hot dog, but I know it's a picture of a hot dog, so it's accessible. And in that sense, Paolozzi is far more complex and far more interesting and far more challenging. But the key to Paolozzi and some of his pals in the early 50s who worked around the ICA, when it was a really, you know, vibrant, exciting gallery, is that they really were at a time when most British artists were producing quite dour 50s-ish interiors, you know, of fairly impoverished spaces or cityscape pictures and so on and so on. There was this other bunch of guys who were saying, the impact of American culture is extraordinary. All this jazz music, all this television, Coca-Cola, refrigerators, you know, electric kettles, you know, housewives with hoovers and stuff. This is all amazing. And they began to reflect back to us this kind of other way of seeing this as more than merely about consumption, as actually embedded in the culture. And of course, we're all consumers now, you know, and I mean, I heard a really nice thought the other day. It was about a different article I was reading, but a really nice thought that somebody suggested that for every act of consumption, every time you go to a shop and buy yourself something, I mean, I don't think they mean a tin of beans, they mean a new coat or a record or something. Mm. Every time you go and consume something like that, you must balance it with an act of creativity. And I like that idea, and I guess that, in a sense, that's what people like Paolozzi and Richard Hamilton and Peter Blake, I guess that's what they were doing.
I could see why that would appeal to you, Dave, in particular. Let's talk about some of the pieces, some of the art itself. Before I came to this, before I sort of started delving in for the programme, I didn't have a great knowledge of Paolozzi, but then, actually, interestingly, from what you've said, I realised that there were a number of things that I'd seen throughout my days, if you like, in snapshot, that were his. So to give a perfect example of that for me is Tottenham Court Road tube station. Mm. You know, it's a fantastic kind of artistic mosaic. Let's call it that. I had no idea that it was him or it was linked to him. And that's a kind of brave move, isn't it? Or it was at the time in terms of, you know, kind of taking art onto the tube. Now it's almost a kind of a uniform thing to do. But
in the mid-80s, I commuted to London for 3 years and I went to Notting Hill Gate. So I went up on the Northern Line, got off at Tottenham Court, across onto the Central Line, saw it every day. It's one of the grimmest of journeys. You know, if I was really down, I would go on the Circle Line just to see a bit of sunlight occasionally.
Just to spoil yourself.
When he did that, bless him, it just livened and brightened it up. And it was, he had a very, very difficult time in his early years, you know, because he was an immigrant and his father and grandfather were dispatched to Canada and the ship was sunk and he never saw them again. They died. And, you know, there has to be some kind of darkness in there somewhere. But he seems to me to overcome it. But I mean, extraordinary, productive, incredible amount of work that he produced. And I think you can push yourself and say, I think there's some coherence to all of this, but you can only do it retrospectively. I really admire people who through a life just open themselves to a new possibility. Oh, screen printing? Ah, sculpture and casting? Okay. Oh, different kinds of images? Yeah, sure, I'll go for that. You know, abstraction? Yeah, we'll try a bit of that. Yeah, I think there are some consistencies through it. Lot of figurative work, a lot of portrait work, for example. I mean, one of the ways of making sense of artists, I think, if you go to big exhibitions of stuff you don't know and you're not familiar with making sense of artists, one of the tricks is to ask yourself, what's not here? And one of the things that's not there is the tradition of English landscape. It's nowhere. Mm-hmm. It's not something that turned him on. I guess he lived his whole life in cities. He was essentially an Italian immigrant family. He's a bit like, you know, the big names Henry Moore and Francis Bacon. He's not a landscape man, which is a big tradition in English painting. He's a person. He's a figure man and a portrait man. And so that's one of the things that comes through for me.
So, I mean, this is a significant exhibition. I think it's, you know, we have to emphasise that. And of the things that were there, what kind of caught your eye? I mean, obviously, you know, he's someone that you've known for a time through sort of, you know, your career and teaching and various other things. But were there particular pieces that you thought, I think you went back, didn't you? You went a couple of times to kind of absorb.
Yeah, I may go again well. Okay. I like it very much. Well, oddly, I was very struck by his student work where he made drawings from Rembrandt and people like that, which I thought were quite lovely and not the sort of thing I've seen at all. I'm really fond of his two-dimensional pop collage with kind of pulp magazine images and so on and so on. And there's a series called Bunk, for example, which do that kind of thing. I mean, I've got one in front of me here and there are illustrations from of kids' toys and a packet of sausages that somebody's holding and so on and so on and little images as well. I don't know really. What I liked about it in the end was the extraordinary energy and enthusiasm. I mean, I even sat with the what I guess you would call abstract film. You know, it's not silent. There's a kind of strange soundtrack juxtaposed to these random images that are just cut together for about 10 minutes. I sat through all of that twice.
It's interesting. When I was kind of researching his work, I really liked the kind of sculpture and the sculptural works that he did. There's one, I think, called The Head of Invention, which sits outside the Design Museum in London. It's hard to describe, but it's a kind of a bust on its side, kind of split into four pieces, and it's reminiscent of, and you pointed this out to me earlier, there's a piece in the exhibition called The Return, which is a portrait, which is essentially made of different elements of, I think, Time magazine's covers over, you know, over a period of months, kind of, I suppose, ripped and drawn over and pulled together to create a new person. And, you know, it's kind of the title itself, The Return, is a provocative one. It's an interesting one because it's kind of what's returning, what's there, what's gone, what's missing? You know, it's those kind of those kind of questions. And, I, you know, looking at a lot of the pop art, kind of, I suppose, more cartoonish elements, not instantly something that appeals to me, but the sculpture, again, I kind of thought, you know, take something like the Sir Isaac Newton kind of sculpture, which I think sits outside British Library somewhere.
Derived from William Blake's illustration,
indeed. So that's quite a cartoony sculpture in some ways. It's quite rounded and it's quite sort of it's quite sort of jovial almost.
Yeah.
But it makes a really serious point. Yeah. And also there's something about where it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, you know, it's Newton's influence on art and literature and culture and all those kind of things. So,
Well, I'm actually holding one a piece of it here, and it, you know, it's clearly cast in bits. Well, I think it's clearly cast in bits, or at least it's made to look as if it is, and then joined together, so collaged together. And you were talking about the head on its side, which is like four bits of a head that have been joined together. So, there's a question there as also about those kinds of images that they're not coherent like traditional portraits. They're not whole. So, are they damaged? Damaged, you know, or is this an act of repair that he's actually taken something damaged and cared for it and put it, or is it a fragmented individual? And, you know, I think the obvious question to ask about those kind of, you know, those kind of quartered and sliced up faces that are put back together is the lineage of this? Does this all begin with Frankenstein's monster?
Interesting.
Where does he sit with all of that?
That's really interesting because, you know, there is that kind of, there is that balance through all of this about you know, you've mentioned it already, that's kind of random versus order, but also random order.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of, you know, there's a really interesting mix from that. And I think for all of his work, you know, as I said, kind of the sculptural stuff appealed to me more, but through all his work, you can get a sense of real vitality from it. You know, he's come to it and he's added something and he's played with it a bit and maybe, you know, he's learned something through the experience and just thought, oh, I don't need to do that again. I want to do something else. I want to do... something different.
I think, like some of those great record producers, for example, he's got such a deeply embedded sense of aesthetics that, you know, people can look at it and say, well, anybody can stick pictures of comics on a, but actually anybody can't like that, you know. And there are strong, there is a strong sense of it. So I mean, I'm holding one here, for instance, that makes good use of diagonal lines and introduces dynamism, and the colours are well balanced. Whereas, you know, there's another piece that's more machine like and more grid like and so on. So what that betrays is somebody who's been through a has got a good aesthetic sensibility and B has been through a good art training, but then that basis allows him just to flourish by saying, oh, we can do this, can we? Okay, I think I'll get on and do it. And because inside there he knows how to sort shapes and colours and lines and, you know, and content out, most of the time it works beautifully.
So Eduardo Palozzi's Collaging Culture is on at the Pallant House Gallery until October 13th, I think.
That's correct, yeah.
And the tickets are £9 admission.
I don't know, because I'm what's called a friend.
Ah, you're a friend. You can become a friend, I think.
You can. I mean, essentially, it means you're a member.
If you want to find out more information about the exhibition, you can go onto the Pallant House website, www.pallant.org.uk, or you can phone the box office on 01243 77457. So I'm with now, in the studio, William Sutton. Will, welcome to Towards the Point.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's great to see you. I think first came across you when you invited me to a book launch, which took place about a month or so ago in Blackwells.
That's right. It was a joint book launch with my friend Diana Bretherick, who's a brilliant crime writer. And it was a fun day.
It was fun, and there were an interesting mix of people there, I think. But you get that in bookshops, don't you? So you were promoting your new book, very excitingly, Lawless and the Devil of Euston Square. Just tell us a bit about that.
Do you know, I never know how to just burst into talking about a book. It's a strange way to talk. Like, when you're talking about records and things, you're kind of saying, oh, what do you like? And, oh, yeah, I like that too. And then suddenly you have to come and sell your own book. It's strange, but I can do it.
Oh, that's... I'm glad. I was going to check who booked him then, but he can do it. So it's a kind of... Is it a Victorian mystery? Is that the best way to describe it?
Yes. It's a kind of subterranean who's going to do it.
Okay, so what made you pick that? Was there... are you a time traveller yourself, or are you just fascinated by that period?
Do you know, I wasn't at all fascinated by that period, and I suckered myself into it by seeing the plaque on the wall at Baker Street Station that says this was the first ever underground train line in the world, and I... that stuck in my head for years, and I kind of tried to picture how did they build it and what was there before, and suddenly I had to become an expert on the 1860s. I dropped myself in that.
And how easy is that to do? Because, you know, I'm guessing that in terms of the research and the kind of reference points, there's a lot out there. There's an abundance of material, if you like. But, you know, how do you kind of frame things? How do you think, that's useful, or that could be included? How do you approach that?
It's a big canvas, and luckily I was really ignorant when I began.
Okay, ignorance is bliss, as they say.
It was lucky, because later I've discovered and chatted to people at crime conferences who are the world expert on the Princess Alexandra disaster of 1878, for example, which I'd never heard of, the ice rink disaster in the Serpentine. So luckily I'd never heard of these. I hadn't even read Dickens, but I'd read Wilkie Collins, mm-hmm. who wrote The Woman in White, and The Moonstone, which are these great sensation novels, which I guess were the kind of crime sensation of the period. They were the kind of Scandi crime, Nordic noir that everyone had to read and everyone went crazy about. And they were buying the newspaper week in, week out. And Dickens was really upset that his friend was selling more than him. And that led me into having a kind of excitement about that world, because people were hypocritical and there was this glorious, clean surface of Victorian society, who were developing lots of engineering wonders that hid the underbelly of darkness and prostitution and degradation.
All the good things in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was it difficult to kind of focus? Because I know certainly, I mean, you know, you've got the success of Sherlock and Sherlock Holmes, and, you know, it's a very successful kind of franchise. The other thing it reminded me slightly of was the Mark Gatiss book, I think it's the Vesuvius Club, where, you know, it's a kind of Victorian quirky crime novel, but was it difficult to sort of phase those things out and focus on, you know, a story?
Oh, I didn't know about the Mark Gatiss book, but it's funny, whoever I tell about it has a new input. So there are people who tell me about Alan Moore, the great graphic novelist, has one, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and William Gibson, the great science fiction writer, has a book from that era. So again, I was trying to pitch something before Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper, before Jekyll and Hyde and Dorian Gray, and I suppose that seemed to give me carte blanche to say I can invent that period. I mean, Dickens is sort of master of the Thames and fog, and Wilkie Collins has this great way of revealing the dark things hidden underneath your own doorstep. And that seemed to leave a little gap that I could nip in through.
There's a great William Blake poem, I think, as well, called London, where he describes the kind of visceral mess of the river. Which, again, it kind of, you know, those are the kind of things I pondered when I was...
I think it makes it easier to invite people into that world, because we all feel we know those kind of tumble-down slums and the Thames swallowing up bodies and dust heaps and train crashes, cruel landlords exploiting...
That's all changed now, of course.
Of course, there's none of that.
There's none of that anymore. So tell us a bit about Campbell Lawless, because he's your main figure, isn't he? He's your protagonist. He's a kind of a fairly novice detective, I think. Or is he a detective, or is he aspiring to be one?
He becomes a detective, kind of, he stumbles into it by accident. And I think I similarly stumbled by accident into having a Scottish detective arriving in the capital, which sort of gives us an excuse.
Now, I've detected from your accent that there's an element of Scotch there.
I'm really pleased you can see that, because I get some doubt, I promise you. Some people, especially English people, doubt my credentials, but I was born and raised there. But it gives a kind of way to explore things that we don't know about. So someone arrives new in the capital, he's wide-eyed and he doesn't know what he's doing, he doesn't understand what's going on behind the scenes. So he stumbles into this web of intrigue and gets elevated into Scotland Yard.
And I'm guessing, you know, we touched on it already, but there are, I think, parallels between 1859, I think, when it's set, and 2013. You know, there's kind of, these are periods of great development and great change. You know, I went to London last week and I thought, oh, hold on, where's that new building come from? You know, the Shard was new when I last went there. Oh, there's three other buildings next to it. You know, it's constant change, isn't it?
It is. There's a great line in a play which I stole in my novel, the Tom Stoppard play, where it's in 1880, they go to the theatre and they've got electric light and they come out and they say, oh my God, you know, every age thinks it's the modern age, but this age really is. And the audience all laugh, kind of, ha ha, those stupid Victorians. And then there's a second laugh of the people who think, huh, someone's going to be laughing at us in 120 years' time.
It's that kind of thing where you only know when the revolution's happening when you're part of the establishment. It's that kind of argument, isn't it?
It's exactly that.
So tell us about, Lawless is kind of embedded as a character in the first book, and there are other books planned. There's a couple coming forward. I've forgotten the titles of them, but there's a couple that are coming out next year and year after.
That's right. I'm working at the moment on the second one, and I've got the third one written, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
It's a long story.
You're one of those lateral thinking people I know.
Well, the stories come to you. Like you were saying, do certain events impinge on you and say, oh, this demands to be put in? So I discovered about the unification of Italy because I was living there, and I wrote a whole book where Campbell goes out to Italy, and that's going to be a little bit later in the series. That's going to be Lawless and the Maestro of the Assassins.
Ooh, there's a title.
Yeah, does it sound too much like a computer game?
No, I like it.
So what I'm writing now, I've come back to London and...
It sounds like an indie band, I think.
Yeah. but then everything sounds like that.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
It's like playing at the Wedgwood Rooms tonight, £5, yeah. But so now I'm back to working on Lawless and the Flowers of Sin.
Is that for the Valentine's Market, maybe?
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
a little light romance.
So you're obviously a very learned gent, and you've got lots of ideas in your head. I'm just really interested to know how you capture those and how the kind of flow of writing comes to you, because you've obviously, are you one of these people that writes on everything when you get a crazy idea, or is it more sort of structured than that? Do you have a process?
No, that's a lovely question. I have a process which keeps breaking down. I tear my hair out and try and develop a new process. I think usually when I get the seed of a new idea, I sit down and I write a few scenes, and I get really excited and I put them together, and then I have a big jumble of papers which make no sense at all. I then have to slice my way through it and hack off all the bits that don't add together and really work and suffer through pain in building a synopsis to make the story have kind of broad shoulders that can hold this weight of intricacy so that you can get the excitement and revelations late in the day.
And is that something you've been doing from an early age? Is that...
Yeah. I never really stopped writing from when I was a kid. I wrote plays when I was at school and at university, and then I wrote some radio plays. And the process, I suppose, got more intricate, and I learned about rewriting and editing as I got all the rejections in from the agents.
It's the only way to learn, hard way, that's what they say. And what about technology? I always ask a number of musicians this. Technology's had a huge impact on the music industry. Mm-hmm. Now it seems that everybody has a Kindle, a Kobo, or Nook, or whatever variant of e-reader. It's more and more accessible. It's easier to read, and literature's more accessible. Do you think that's altered the kind of the way people write, or the kind of the pace of writing?
I think it's going to. I think the technical side of the book industry has been 5 or 10 years behind the music industry, but they've learnt something from the music industry being so pig-headed about it, about saying, oh, nobody will ever pay 60p for a track, it's never going to work, let's ban it. And the book industry has been able to come along and say, well, actually, if someone's going to pay 60p for a short story, that's brilliant. And there are people working in both novels and more interactive ebooks, which are just getting developed. There's Faber put out an interactive Wasteland, and you can get kind of Philip Larkin's poetry where he reads it and you pause it. And
you can edit the one out about your parents, I think. And I guess it puts you in control in the same way that the music industry, it allows you to produce and to publish on your own if you want to, if you need to even.
It potentially does. I just read that Stephen King's put out a short story with Amazon. What have they called it? The Kindle Shorts. They've got a new short label on Amazon. And he was saying, if I give this to my publisher, maybe it'll come out in 10 years' time with a collection. I gave it to Amazon on Friday. He said it came out on Monday.
It's incredible, isn't it?
So I think you're also, like musicians, you can do it on all these big levels. You can go with your big label for the revelatory big album, but you can slip out little things here and there. Your fans can seek things out. I can put a short story in my website and a few people read it. It's very satisfying. I read at festivals and people ask me, where can I get that story? And I say, oh, well, you can
even get software that just translates an audio recording. We can make a book out of this interview. Who knows? We could 60p at least. The possibilities are endless, or limited, I'm not sure. Let's move to talk about some of the journalism that you've done. You've obviously now kind of flourishing as a creative writer, but you've done some journalism, and you've done, strangely, you've worked for The Times and for the Fortean Times. Now, if no one knows what the Fortean Times is, I think that's how it's pronounced. Explain what that is. Is that a kind of fifth column magazine? Is that how you'd refer to it?
It's certainly a journal of strange phenomena. They put out those great books. Have you seen the 14 Times Book of Strange Deaths and Strange Crimes? The Strange Deaths one's really fantastic. The oddest ways people have died around the world. The Charles Fort was a strange thinker who went to the British Library and said, you know all those stories that nobody quite believes? If you read them all back to back, you kind of put yourself into a strange brain space where you start to think something's behind them, even if we can't prove that. So that's a whole magazine. It's a whole world of people. Have you met any of that lot?
Some. You do workshops as well, which I guess, you know, is more sort of, as their name suggests, more interactive. You do lots of different things. And one of the things that I picked up on, which you said earlier before we started recording, you said there's an inelegant word, was you do something called reauthoring. Now, reauthoring, the way I read it is it's warming up last night's dinner to make it a bit spicier. Is that right, or am I being a bit churlish?
I'm going to feed that back to people
who invented it. Feed that one back.
No, you're quite right. Reauthoring.co.uk is a group of people who said, when you go to book festivals, when you go to author readings, it can be great, but just a bit too often it's a little dry and you feel not everyone got everything out of it they could. I went to the Neil Gaiman thing just now. And he's just fantastic because he's so relaxed. He's really telling you about his life. He was interested in Portsmouth. He grew up here partly. And so I've got no comment about that. His readings were so clear and warm and such conviction. Not complaining about him. But you know the kind of spark that you get from an author when you really hear them talking about something they're excited about? It's saying, couldn't you get back to some of that and have a bit of the wildness and the craziness in your performance? Maybe you don't have to perform sitting in a chair with a serious panel asking you questions and answers. So that's why I got the ukulele. And that's why I've been performing on top of ships and in an Italian restaurant and in a field in Canterbury a couple of weeks ago.
Well, let's move to music then, because you mentioned the ukulele, which is an instrument you and I have in common. The Christmas single could start from here, but you've done some songwriting projects and you've used music, I think, in a number of different ways. And the book launch we mentioned right at the start, you did a little, a wonderful little kind of piece. It was a kind of little parade, a little piece, a kind of something almost out of Victorian theatre. You know, you were almost the sort of the bard, you know, leading the sonnet, that kind of thing. And it was great, and people really warmed to it. And it was much better than sort of saying, "Yeah, here's my book, it's available. Hasn't it got a nice cover?" You kind of brought elements of it to life, and it's kind of is that something you want to do more of, or is that something that's always been there?
It hasn't always been there. I always acted, and I always did music. And I kind of had a line separating that world from my writing. And when I was in the Edinburgh Festival a few years ago, I was invited to be in a Victorian kind of dialogue with a chap who'd edited this real Scottish detective stories. And we chatted about it in the pub and we came out with all these clever ideas. We could say, oh, we're still influenced by the Victorians today and all the big companies still. And we were fine, but we were just a bit dry. And afterwards, I found out this chap was an amazing blues guitarist. And we could have sung the same things improvised. And it would have been just as serious, except...
That would be great, wouldn't it, if people sung meetings? You know, kind of, here's the agenda, it's in the Court of Sea.
It could work, couldn't it? In the Portsmouth Guildhall, you could
say... I'm going to write that down. Right, now, excitingly, you're going to have a pluck for us. You're going to do a little tune.
I wrote a devilish book about worms, but in fact they're little urchins who in no uncertain terms the dark mysteries unfurl of London's underworld, befriending princes and policemen, but society treats them like germs. Ooh, the Victorians, that's the sing-along bit, so lusciously lascivious, so strenuously stentorian. Ooh, the Victorians. Hysterical histrionics to enravish a historian. Victorianic London, what a hoot. Full of engineering glory, full of smut and smoke and soot. Bold hydraulic engines, sewer and metropolitan. The backdrop haunting that we're wanting for our mystery books. Well, ooh, the Victorians. Ooh, the Victorians. May I give my thanks to the King of the Buttons. I hope your listeners do enjoy the sound of William Sutton's Victorianic book. It might be worth a look As Express FM explores the literature, other FMs are forsook. Ooh, the Victorians. I think that's probably enough. Ooh, the Victorians.
So, Will, what's next for Lawless? You alluded to a couple of books, a sequel, and a sequel to the sequel. That's coming. The next one's coming out in August next year, in 2014. And then hopefully the third one's coming out the year later, is that right?
That's the plan, yeah. I've got a little bit of work to do on Lawless and the Flowers of Sin, but I'm trying to delve into the darkness underneath my soul and shovel it onto the page for all to see.
It's never easy. What else have you got coming up? What kind of events and things are you up to in the next few months or so? You mentioned Bookfest, obviously.
Yeah, I've been doing lots of performances through these reauthoring people. It's really good to get outside, away from the desk, and actually meet some human beings. So there's a thing called the Portsmouth Writers Hub. When I moved here about 4 years ago, I didn't know anyone, and I sort of thought, oh, I'm going to be this lonely writer guy living in my garret. And then I went to a meeting and met all these writers who are actually as serious as I am about it. I was shocked, pleasantly shocked. And we've all started doing performances together. So we got some things coming up. We're in the book festival, The Day of the Dead, at the Square Tower on the 30th of October, which is not quite Halloween, and it's not quite Ghost Stories, The Day of the Dead. It's quite wide.
It sounds intriguing and slightly unnerving already.
Yeah. So that's me presenting Portsmouth Writers Hub to the city. And then I happen to be on separately the next night in Aspects Gallery in this great thing called the Fire Station Book Swap. It's a bit of a cult because you can pay your ticket entry or you can bring a cake. And these great writers, Scott Pack and Marie Phillips, invite a couple of writers that they like. People put questions in a hat, but they're not to be too direct. So they ask you things like, if you were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be? And then people bring a book to swap, and you stand up in the audience and you say, you know, I really like this book, but I've read it now. Would anyone like it? And then you swap it for something like, you know, I brought along Latin love poetry. It was a big hit.
Will, it's been really lovely to get you into the studio and to have a chat. Tell us where we can find out more of, where we can gather your wares, as it were.
I'm william-sutton.co.uk. Like a hyphen.
Yeah, well, it's got to be there, isn't it?
That's smooth. I've never said that on radio before. william-sutton.co.uk. I'm at WilliamGeorgeQ on Twitter.
Excellent.
People can write and abuse me there.
Well, we will watch your progress with interest. It's been great to get you in, and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Cheers, thanks. We move now to one of Dave's favourite subjects, rock and roll, and more specifically, Access All Areas, which is some very interesting things going on at the back of the Guildhall.
And it's got to be rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
Very definitely,
indeed.
Yes. They are very interesting things. I was called to a meeting in February, and I met the people that now run the Guildhall, which is a community trust, and I don't really understand those kinds of organisations, but it's very interesting. They're trying to do all kinds of things there, public lectures and all sorts of different gigs, not just the main stage, but, you know, the little cafe areas and so on and so on, really trying to bring it to life. And one of the things that they want to do is to begin to exhibit histories of aspects of Portsmouth, one of which they hope will be a history of the Guildhall itself, you know, back to its Victorian roots. But of course, what they did with me and a couple of my pals, Mick Cooper and Nigel Grundy in particular, they called us in because of Pompey Pop Picks and Pompey Pop and this whole history of local popular music that we've been running for some years now, which dates really from the Second World War. Realistically, in terms of our experience, knowledge and so on, up to about 1970, what they're trying to do is to encourage us to take it even further, and we're trying to get other people involved in that. And we said, yeah, fine. So what they asked us to do was to set up a series of kind of gallery exhibitions in rooms that had been offices and even corridors up in the northern side of the Guildhall, so overlooking the town station on the first floor, which is complemented by a very nicely designed exhibition space where they are bringing in curated exhibitions, the first of which I think has come from the Victoria and Albert Museum and is Rolling Stones early 1970s.
It's called Rip This Joint, the Rolling Stones 1972, and it's created by Dave Brolin.
It is. That's right. Yes, I didn't meet him. I met somebody else who came down to install it. It's essentially pictures of the guys rehearsing and in the studio around that time that they were over, particularly over in France, recording a new album, and they're all very nice, very stylish kind of black and white pictures. Mostly Mick and Keith, it has to be said. This was after Brian Jones had left and died, and so Mick Taylor's there. And Charlie and Bill are around, and one or two other musicians, Bobby Keys and so on. But
it's quite nicely laid out as well, isn't it? Most of the photos, I think, are black and white images.
I think they all are. I can't quite remember now, but I think they all are. Yeah.
But it's kind of, there's a very clear sort of journey, a kind of journey of travel, if you like, through the rooms and into the wider archive. And I think what they've tried to do at the Guildhall is get a balance in terms of changing contemporary exhibition, temporary space, if you like, and, more permanent history of Guildhall and Pompey Pop, if you're going to ask anyone about Pompey Pop, you're the man, aren't you? You're the kind of one of the 18.
Well, I'm one. There's a little group of us now, actually, and it's really rather lovely. But I suppose at certain points I've been as central to it as anybody else, and it's a funny sort of thing, really. But we've had great fun, and I was saying to you earlier that it kind of connects to the piece we've just recorded about the Paolozzi exhibition, because what we've done in these corridors and other rooms is really treat it, I think, like a giant walk-through scrapbook. And that's not to say that it's scrappy. At least I hope people don't think it's scrappy. We've taken a lot of time over, designing and printing and blowing up pictures and so on. But we had the most enormous fun actually putting it up. It was pretty pressured in terms of time, so we were doing long days there. But what we've essentially done is to treat all these images like wallpaper, and literally, wallpaper pasted them all to the walls. So if anybody gets fed up with the exhibition, it's going to be an interesting job to get it off. And having wallpapered all these things to the walls, we've then written all over the walls in permanent marker pens, which is also great fun.
Radical surrealists, I know, hiding out of the back. Now, last time, I think, one of the last times I saw you, you were, in fact, sticking some of that onto the wall, and it looks great. I have to say, the way you describe it, perhaps on radio, people think, "Oh, hold on, what's all of that?" But there is a stopping point, isn't there? There's visibly a bit of the corridor that's a blank. Sure. There's some space. Now, I thought that was because you wanted to avoid the light switch, and that maybe that's part of it. But there is a point at which it's kind of, it's not that history stops. It's just that you're looking for more archive material, and I suppose we're appealing for people to come forward with their point. Which point in time does it kind of fizzle out?
Well, early 70s, really, because what's happened is that Mick and Nigel and I grew up through the 50s and the 60s locally, and even bits that we didn't know that were slightly before us, we've done an enormous amount of research, and people have given us stuff. I mean, this project has really been buzzing since about 2009, but actually it started with the City Museum back in 2003, so it's had a long gestation period, and I think we all feel quite confident and comfortable now when people say to us, what were the major venues in the 60s? Who were the big visitors that came in the 60s? Who came to the Guildhall? We know that. We have a narrative. I mean, people can always say, you didn't get that quite right, and you can never get those histories complete, but we're pretty confident about that. But once you get to the 70s and the 80s, there are bits of stories that I know reasonably well, and bits of stories that I haven't got a clue about. So there was a really lively punk scene in Portsmouth in the late 70s, which has been nicely documented in a book by Tony Rollinson, but we don't really have the pictures now to collage on the wall. And there was an interesting kind of rock and roll revival scene from the 70s, a great group called Shazam, but other groups as well.
I suppose you're looking for, if there are people listening to this show now, you're looking for people who might have some memories, knowledge, kind of nostalgic pieces about that time. If you are listening and you want to contact us, you can do so through our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com, or you can email us here Express FM.
And you're right about that. I think what would be great would be to discover people who, even if it's only for 5 years, have got a good overview and could say to us, well, you need this picture of these guys and you need this picture of these guys and so on. Not just, actually, I happen to have loads of pictures of the band I was in. They were great. Don't mind that, but that's not giving us the picture. The other thing people can do, of course, is take stuff to the Guildhall. There is a reception there, and we are. I have picked up some stuff from the last 10 years, for example, which I'm going to organise quite soon.
That's a more practical, traditional method, isn't it? But a very effective one, I think. Yeah, but, and Dave, you're probably unusual in that the 70s was a blur for you, and the 60s you can remember quite a lot of.
Well,
probably not all of.
I got a new view of all of that. They say if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. Well, my view of it, for people like me and Mick and Nigel, is if you can remember the 60s, you're still there.
OK, so the Rolling Stones exhibition is on until the 2nd of November. Yeah. And the general exhibition space is permanent. It'll be there. It'll be an ongoing project. Yeah. It's, I think, £3 admission to the exhibitions.
I think so. But there are reductions, for instance, if you go to events at the Guildhall or whatever, and certainly I hope that the enlarged Pompey Pop bit will go on forever.
Now, we were talking, I hope so too, we were talking earlier about the 60s scene, and there are a couple of references in the exhibition space, to two of, I think, probably the biggest broadcasters in Britain who have sadly passed away end of August and beginning of September. We are, of course, talking about Sir David Frost and David Jacobs. Now, let's start with Frost, because Frost is huge, isn't he? He is there, I think, probably in the 60s, early 60s, with That Was the Week That Was. Yeah. It was a big Saturday night show, drew in audiences of around 12 million, which at the time was quite significant.
Yeah.
But the important thing about it was that it was satire and it was in your face and it was kind of lampooning the establishment, which perhaps hadn't been done in that way before.
Oh, it certainly hadn't been done in that way, really. There'd been the craziness of the Goons, which was, if you like, satirising a certain kind of, you know, bourgeois sensibility, but in a loony way, if you like. There were moments with David. The most famous was there was a man called Savundra who was involved in all kinds of crooked deals and so on and so on. And Frost just grilled him on the show and you know, challenged his whole moral position in a way that excited people. But it was certainly amusing. I mean it's in a sense anticipated some of the things that Monty Python did, but in a less absurd way, and it was part of a radical shift in British culture and British society that coincided with some very significant things. There was the court case to try to criminalise the publication of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which lost, in a sense the British intellectual class of the time, came largely to the defence of the publication of that novel and saying, this is not pornography, this is art, and people are allowed to use that kind of language and that describe those activities. Some of it was very serious like that. And then, of course, there was the Christine Keeler Profumo scandal and the resignation of a government minister for lying to the House.
Frost has taken on new significance, I think, with the kind of Frost Nixon film and all, the kind of the stage show and all those kind of things. But for me, what comes out of, and I can remember growing up watching Frost, on Sunday or him on TVAM, which he had a part in starting. But there's a phrase, there's a description of Frost, which is this kind of acerbic interrogation. What he does very well, or what he did very well, was he had the good humour and he had the personable touch to get people to a point where he could go for the jugular, but do so in a kind of diplomatic way. And there was real, real skill in doing that.
He's not Paxman.
He's not Paxman.
No, I don't mind Paxman because I think Paxman is a particular individual, and there have been others like it. One of Frost's contemporaries who was a bit like a predecessor of Paxman was Robin Day, for example. Yeah. But I think you're quite right about that, and I think to some degree that skill has been lost. I think there are too many presenters on television, and there's probably too many television news channels anyway. There are too many presenters who think, if it's a difficult issue, I've got to be angry with whoever it is I'm interviewing. I've got to attack as if I'm speaking on behalf of the public. Sometimes that's fine, but sometimes you can catch people in different kinds of ways.
Now let's talk about David Jacobs, who is another great broadcaster. Yeah. And I suppose, most people would know David Jacobs from Jukebox Jury, okay, which, again, before my time, but between 59 and 67... Yeah. Was pretty much, I think, the only way, well, not the only way, but one of the main ways that people could access and find new pop tunes and new rock and roll records or hear things first.
That's right. And what it was a really simple entertainment. I mean, there were alternatives. There was a thing on ITV called Thank Your Lucky Stars where you would actually see the Rolling Stones perform. Now, occasionally, Jukebox Jury did really push the boat out, and it had the Beatles as its four panellists, or it had the Rolling Stones as its five panellists, and they misbehaved by and large. But generally speaking, it was a quite simple format for entertaining young people, where at the time when you didn't hear records a lot on the radio, all you did actually was to see, they were usually actors and actresses and comedians, you know, who kind of nodded their head to, I don't know, 40 seconds of a snatch of a pop song and then said, well, I like the beat, I'm not sure about the lyrics, I'll vote it a hit, you know. And I mean, it was an odd thing, really. But the other thing to say about David Jacobs, though, is, I mean, he was a very urbane presenter, not at all a 60s pop presenter, really. But he was very, very good, and he did do one of the first chart shows on BBC before Alan Freeman took it on. Mm. And Alan Freeman was much more kind of smashy and nicey, wasn't he? Hi there, yeah. Poppers, you know. And I mean, David Jacobs always sounded, you know, terribly well educated, really, and very nicely spoken. And I thought in later years, it was interesting that as I became more fond of that much older popular music, which I suppose I would characterise as, you know, Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra or whatever. Mm. I enjoyed hearing him in that very old fashioned, that very pre-60s voice and manner. But again, there was a politeness to it. I mean, he wasn't doing what Frost was doing, of course. He wasn't pushing issues and so on and so on. But he was what I suppose what would be called the consummate professional. And as you say, it happens entirely by chance that before either of them died, I did put images of both that Was a Week That Was and Jukebox Jewellery in the show, because alongside the Pompey Pop pictures, what we've got is context from the bigger world of popular culture and entertainment and so on. So
amazingly, David Jacobs worked in radio, in broadcasting, for 65 years. Yeah. You know, so yeah. I think there's hope for us yet.
Goodness me. I'm not sure about another 65.
Okay, just before we go, we've got time to catch up with some forthcoming events. And rather excitingly, we're going to focus, I think, on the Bookfest. So Portsmouth Bookfest is coming up between the 19th of October and the 3rd of November. And Dave, there's a few things that have caught your eye immediately.
There are. Well, there's quite a lot, really, some of which I know more about than others. There's a fun thing that they did last year called Girls' Night In with Carol Matthews, Ali McNamara and Christina Jones. Join us, it says, for an evening of pampering laughs and book talk with three of Britain's top female authors, courtesy of Little Brown Publishers. And that's coming on the 29th of October. Incidentally, you can get all the information about this in the libraries. There's lots of posters and pamphlets. So that's a real fun one. The other thing that I'll mention immediately, because I had a little bit of involvement in it, is a book which won the winner of the Rugby Book of the Year Award for this year, the British Sports Book Awards. And it's called The Final Whistle, or A Rugby Club at War, 1914 to 1918. What it does is to tell the story of Rosslyn Park Rugby Club and 15 men at Rosslyn Park who played rugby for them before the Great War, went off to war and never returned. He tells the story of each of these 15 men. The reason I have a particular interest in it is that I was slightly involved in it in my capacity as the historian at Hampshire Cricket, because one of those 15 men also played cricket for Hampshire. He was a solicitor over in Southampton. And as it happens, that's a very different event from the Girls' Night In. It's on the same night, 29th of October. The Girls' Night In is on the first floor of the Central Library. They're not sure yet about that other event, the rugby event, but it could be at Portsmouth Rugby Club, apparently.
Excellent, sounds good. The West Sussex Authors' Day is happening on the 20th of October, and that's an event, really, I think, aimed at budding writers and authors. There's all kinds of things going on at Southsea Castle between 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock. Tickets are £5 for each session.
Jacqueline Wilson, it describes as Britain's favourite female children's author. She's going to turn up at Portsmouth Grammar School on the 19th of October and talk about her books and new novel, Diamond. And it says limits will apply on the number of people who will be able to meet Jacqueline after the talk to have books signed, and only books bought at the event will be signed, one book per child and so on. Because I know that sometimes people do turn up with mountains of the things, and sometimes they appear on eBay. I think people are not too keen on that, but you can go and meet her, and that sounds fun.
Now, there's some guy on the 23rd of October called Dave Allen doing a talk about Pompey Pop, popular music in Portsmouth 44 the 69, and that's at the East Knee Cellars.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to sit on the stage. Yeah, and not play any music. Actually, oddly, 3 days after I've got a gig there. But yeah, I'm going to sit on the stage and just talk about not just about the book, although I will have the last few copies of the book because it's nearly sold out now, which is absolutely fantastic. But I'm going to talk about what it is to try and build and construct a history of something like popular culture and popular music in a place like Portsmouth that doesn't have a national reputation. You know, it's not like writing a history of pop music in Liverpool, for instance. It's different. You know.
I shall be there at the bar heckling.
Yeah, quite right, mate. Yeah.
Another one to mention at the end of October, nearly towards the end of the festival, on the 30th of October, is Zones of Avoidance, which is Maggie Sawkins, a friend of this programme, yeah, at the Menuhin Theatre in the Portsmouth Central Library at 2:30 p.m. Tickets are £4, and it's billed as a word dance into the void of addiction. There you go. What more could you get for £4?
You know, you won't get anything like that from me.
You won't get anything like that. Also, a couple of other things locally, if you want to go and check them out. Johnny Burrell, I believe it's pronounced, him of Razorlight fame, is playing at the Wedgwood Rooms on Sunday, the 6th of October at 8 o'clock. You can find out more information at wedgwoodrooms.co.uk. And also, I wanted to mention this because it's a very scary picture on the leaflet. I'm sure the kids are running out of the library crying. Number 6 Cinema on the 31st of October, which obviously I believe is around Halloween time, they'll be showing Nosferatu, which is a scary film.
It is a scary
film. And one of the first films ever made, I think.
It is a scary film. It's a good advert for nail clippers, that one. Can I mention one other thing, which is a band called Aubrey Small that existed in Portsmouth in around 1970 and made what became a cult album on Polydor. And they've long since split up, but most of them are getting back together for a gig in Portsmouth, which I think has already sold out. But the thing to look out for is Record Collector Magazine are going to reissue 500 copies of the album on vinyl. And I'm certainly talking to Pye and Vinyl about having a few in stock. So that's a rather lovely Pompey Pop event.
We will have to press gang them into doing that. That's it for this show. If you want to check out some of the things that we've been talking about, you can check out our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. There's a full show archive on there, so you can listen to all of the programmes from the last two series. Dave, thanks very much. It's been great to have you back, and hopefully Simon will be back with us for this third series.
Get well soon, Simon.
Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.